Thank you. And just to clarify our little conversation there, when I started teaching, I felt like I was too young to teach. And so I was a little hesitant to divulge my age. And so I elected to tell my students when I was 20 that I was 39. And I smiled real big to make sure they knew that two students thought it was probably true. So I had to make that right. But ever since then, I've always said I'm 39. It's a perfect age all my life. I'm not over the hill. I'm just sort of at the peak. I don't know how that really works, actually. It probably doesn't. It is good to be here this morning. And I'm grateful for this kind of week, when 275 teachers come together to think about their work, their art. I personally am also grateful most of the time for the push to study fairly deeply in the area of the history of Christian education. After I agreed to do these presentations, I wondered, what in the world was I thinking? So I intend to take 2,500 years of history, smash it into 3 days and a little bit, and then make some comments on Friday. I'm not a historian, and I do enjoy history, but I'm not a historian. And I've chosen to approach this a certain way. I'd like to take the approach of a somewhat chronological picture. We'll keep having to back up and go again, because nothing in history is this neat and tidy that you can just put it into these separate little containers and we just go from one container to the next. It really doesn't work that way. And so I can't force it into that. I'm not going to try. But I'd like to give you a flavor. I'd like to give you some ideas about what actually was. I am concerned that among us, as Anabaptist teachers, that we see our work as teachers as part of a larger stream. We tend to not see what we're doing as a part of something larger than ourselves. It's very difficult to teach school long term without the energy and vision that comes from understanding the backdrop, the context in which you find yourself every day. Cicero, Rome's primary thinker, said, "Not to know what took place before you were born is to remain forever a child." My intent here is not to be exhaustive by any way, it's impossible, but to whet your appetite, to understand how have we gotten to where we are today. I'm particularly indebted to these resources, although there are more. These particular books have been very helpful in my preparation, and I intend to take Paul Keenel's approach, as I noted, which is the idea of chronology, trying to frame it somewhat chronologically. I intend to offer that picture. I think it will help. It will be the most helpful for us in here, although there are lots of approaches to take here. History gives a sense of identity, purpose to individuals, people groups, cultures, and nations. And knowing the history of Christian education, I believe, will help us in choosing a good direction for our future. I do come with a sense that our schools are in trouble. I talk with a lot of people. It's one of the joys of what I do here. And there's a lot of trouble out there. There's always been a lot of trouble in schools, actually. But it seems to me we are facing something we maybe have not faced in the past. And by Friday, I hope to land the airplane and talk about what that is. In the meantime, I want to simply tell the story. In the last several thousand years, churches and individuals, leadership, have disagreed in their purposes for education. We're going to find that over and over. In many cases, there's been both ignorance and truth. But through all of this, the Christian church has served as a central part of educating our people. It's had many faults. In fact, during the medieval period, if it were not for the Christian church, I don't want to think about where you and I would be. You'll also find that whenever vibrant churches were found, they saw themselves as having a vested interest in the education of their young people. Wherever the vibrant church was found, it mattered. Now, as cultures, times, philosophies, and worldviews have shifted and changed, the educational landscape continues to shift and change as well. Now, there's many reasons for this, but there's simple things like geography, economics, natural events, powerful leaders, and yes, philosophers. I find it interesting, though, that the two longest-running institutions of the Western world are Jewish education and Christian school education. Christians who believed that Jesus had authority in their lives and came under the authority of Scripture had a high view of education. And they felt that the way they taught had implications for many, many decades to come. That's how people saw it. Well, we're also going to notice as we work this week at understanding our history, we're going to notice that the Christian education movement always depended on people for its continuation. It always needed people. It had books. It had texts. It had the Bible. It had all kinds of things, but it always had to have the teacher. And so as I tell a minuscule portion of what's available to us today in history, I ask that you make connections with today. Find yourself in what's happening today. I'd encourage you not to worry so much about the specifics of what I'm about to say, but more the themes and the ideas. And so I'm not actually planning that you'll take a stack of notes away. In fact, I'm going to try to make sure you don't do that. So I'm not going to give you all kinds of things up here. I'm going to give you some quotes, some chronology, a map to kind of keep us organized. But I really want us to feel the stream of history, not all the specifics. The specifics are helpful in that they give it color. But we want to see the big picture. As Jesus spoke to a crowd in the temple, he prophesied the destruction of Jerusalem. He said, "The days will come in which not one stone will be left upon another." This prophecy was carried out in two stages. In AD 70, the Roman Emperor Vespasian sent his son Titus with a very large military to Jerusalem. And you know the story. After 7 months of siege, they destroyed the temple. However, it was not a very complete destruction, and Jesus' words still had not been fulfilled until AD 132, in which Emperor Hadrian had Jerusalem demolished and plowed over, and just to make sure the Jews knew where they stood, built a pagan temple on the old temple site and forced the Jews to pay an annual tax for its upkeep. In your face. Of course, this caused what we know today as the Great Dispersion, and the Jewish believers were forced to move all over the Roman Empire. Of course, in this way, the gospel was spread throughout the then-known world. The church had a fervor that the Romans found extremely disconcerting. There was high energy for the cause of Christ in the church. The church had become in some obscure corner of the Roman Empire as a small group, a small community of several hundred believers. Really an outcast sect of an outcast race. But at the end of the first century, you find Christian communities in practically every province of the Roman Empire. And by the beginning of the 4th century, it was obvious Christianity was here to stay. Now, Jewish and Gentile Christians migrated to a very pagan city called Rome. Petronius, governor, said famously, "Our country is so full of divinities that it is much easier to find a god than a man." Romans had a god for every phase of life, literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of gods. And the chief purpose of these gods was to avert calamity, to read the future, to know what is to come, to understand the universe, the world they lived in, and for personal help. They saw the need for something larger and relied on these divinities, these gods. However, the Roman religion never did ask for personal morality in living. Well, what do Jewish believers do that had school-aged children? Jewish Christians were used to Jewish elementary schools, and these schools met in the homes of teachers or largely in synagogues. In fact, Jews, the idea of compulsory education is not new. Try 75 BC, when the Jews said, every child will go to school. These schools were called the House of the Book, with the books of the Old Testament as their curriculum. We're going to come actually back to Jewish education then. Well, what do Gentiles believers do? What do Gentile believers do that had school-aged children? What does a Gentile do? Well, they felt little need, almost none, I would say, for the kind of education that Rome offered. And when they looked at the character of those who were educated, they had no desire to put their children into that context. They said, there's no way. Elmer Wild said, and I quote, "They were bitterly opposed to the subjects taught in the pagan schools, and blamed pagan culture for the vices and corruption of pagan society. To them, its literature was full of impurities. Its art depicted immoralities and was associated with immoral religions. Its philosophy undermined and destroyed Christian faith because it led to trusting one's own wisdom. The pagan school was the enemy of the church, and its curriculum was to be despised by all true believers. Physical training, literature, art, science, rhetoric, human philosophy, all were eliminated from the Gentile system, from early Christian education, and subjects quite foreign to the later pagan schools, especially moral and religious training, took place." Now, this is quite countercultural, is it not? Everywhere in Rome, you are finding paganism. Gentiles said, there's no way. There's no way we're doing this. So the early Christians in their house schools, especially for Gentiles, in their house schools focused on Levitical law. That would be agriculture and civil law. They included health classes, math, reading, and music built on the Psalms. Early Christians were actually forced to make the choice of having their children learn at the feet of those who saw gods and goddesses as powerful and as the way, or start their own schools. And what did the Gentiles do? They started their own schools. As the early church grew, it grew exponentially in the next several hundred years. There were a lot of Christian scholars with influence. In fact, it appears some of the best educated men were Christian apologists, such as Ignatius of Antioch, Justin Martyr, you've heard of Tertullian, Origen, Augustine, Polycarp. Christianity produced some amazing apologists. Now, during this time of growth, there were no special buildings used for either church or school. People met in homes and had schools in their homes. But the one thing that was true in that era for the early church was it mattered how the children were educated. Josephus wrote, "Our ground is good, and we work it to the utmost. But our chief ambition is for the education of our children." Lewis Sherrill notes this. About the end of the first century, there were several references from various parts of the church urging upon parents certain aspects of their duty toward their own children and stressing the importance of their education. The implication plainly is that as soon as Christian communities began to be stable congregations into which children were born, it was recognized that children should have Christian teaching. They saw this more broadly, though, than just the school. Parents saw it as their responsibility to teach and train. But typically, they said, we can't do it alone. And they started their little house schools. Harvey Graff wrote this, "A new tradition of Christian schooling dates from these early centuries after the birth of Christ." In part, it was the centrality of reading the Holy Scriptures, reflecting that aspect of Christianity's origins that stressed the Word as written, and building on the Greek and Roman achievements in literacy and its popular dissemination. At the heart of this impulse was the inseparable connection of schooling with morality, which constitutes a major legacy. In other words, it was more than just the subjects. The early church said there's something way beyond knowing how to read and write. But they said, you have to do that. Now we need to go backwards again. We must look at the overview of the beginnings of education in the Greek, Roman, and Jewish era in more detail. Paul Keenel said, and I quote, "The education patterns established by Sparta, Athens, Rome, and Jerusalem have shaped almost every form of education in the Western world." If that's true, it matters that you know what I'm about to talk about. If that's true. And I know some of you who aren't into history and aren't into the stuff of history, God bless you. I hope you can overcome some inertia there. This matters. In fact, I'm astounded. The time of the Reformation, do you know who people are referring to the time of Reformation? The people I'm about to talk about now. 1,500 years later, incredibly enduring. Does it matter that we know this? I think it does. And I think it's because of that passion that I take the risk of talking to people, which I hope you're not one of those, talking to people about this, the history of our education. A note here first. While Sparta, Athens, and Rome are the backdrop, the context in which Christians lived and developed their ideas, Christian education was very different from the accepted practice of the day. So I'm going to talk about Athens and Sparta and Rome. But these cultures did not accept God at the center of all of life. And that was the distinct difference. Another note, the Greek culture developed an alphabet. And it was huge. Without the alphabet, have you thought about how you teach your children to read? Okay, well, there was a time. Greeks developed, actually, an alphabet, which allowed for the written word, which allowed for, really, the gospel to go out. And, of course, became very clear very quickly that the language was going to be very much Greek, spread all over. There was a common language. You could travel from here to there and actually understand each other. That mattered in what we're about to say. The Greeks probably had the most profound impact on Christian education of any nation or any culture of any time. Although Christianity found much of its content in the Jews, the Greeks contributed the philosophy of education, the curriculum structure, and the methods. That's really what it shook out to be. Now, that's oversimplified. I recognize that. We begin with Sparta. The purpose of a Spartan education was to prepare young people for military service and to get all the males to come under the state, under the thumb of the state. That was the bottom line. If you lived in Sparta, that's what it was about. Education existed for the benefit of the state. So did all men. Everyone existed for the state. The state was king. The Spartan government even arranged marriages for men when they turned 30. And all the children were seen as property of the government. A child's mother was a state nurse, not a mother. And she was to raise the child in a state-approved way. That's all education. We're talking about schooling and education. Christian schools, but in education, Sparta had all the bases covered. They told you when to get married, when not to get married. They told you what to do with the children. How are you going to raise your children? Everything was very carefully defined. The purpose of education was to prepare students not for personal independence. It was not to prepare them to make a living. It was a life of service to the state. Its aim was to rear, Elmer Wilds says, a nation physically invincible, capable of enduring hunger, thirst, torture, or even death without flinching, a people unequal to military skill with absolute devotion to the state. Plutarch said about the Spartans, as for learning, they had just what was absolutely necessary. And what was necessary then was not reading, writing, and arithmetic. That was not important to a Spartan. They worked their beliefs out incredibly effectively. They used flogging was one of their methods of education. You got to teach people to not flinch when they're persecuted or hurt or when they're in a fight or when they're in war. Unbelievable stories coming out of Spartan education. Incredibly cruel to their own people. One mother one day came to a school and offered her son to him and said he didn't get his, I'll put it in today's lingo, didn't get his homework done. And since the dad was away with the military, she said, I want you to beat him until he understands that's not how Spartans do. And he commenced to beat. And beat, and beat, and beat. Until he was within a thread of his own life. And the mother said, what if he doesn't understand yet? Beat him some more. These stories are common. Education was very important to the Spartans, but it was a certain kind of education. These schools existed 700 years. Powerful, powerful system. Then we have Athens, just 200 miles away. It was the capital city of Athens, and during the Golden Age of Greece, Athens had a population of several hundred thousand people. Included in that was 70,000 slaves. Wealthy people, they had silver mines. Of course, slaves did most of the work. You'd hate to get dirty. And all these people groups were addicted to the idea of an easy life. Pleasure was important. But Athens eventually became the intellectual, cultural, and political capital of the then known world. Now, education in Athens was for boys, as it was in Sparta. And, however, the girls were trained in homemaking. It was not state-run. And so mothers trained their daughters. The goal in Athens was to make male citizens fit for full participation in government. And they valued reason above all. They saw every individual as a tiny microcosm of society. Athens knew that for their city-state to survive, their young people had to be equipped with relational skills, be able to communicate, be able to think about what happened, and not just the military subjects. We will find it much more appealing to look at Athenian education. Athens was close to a port city, as you can see on the map there. Very close to sea. And they understood the value of understanding other cultures because their livelihood depended on it. You had to know something about others. Locally, we have a man who sells hydraulic pumps to around the world. Right here in Guy's Mills, wouldn't you know? And what's fascinating there is that he has to go over to Asia, often Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, places like this, where they make pumps for John Deere and Caterpillar and all those places. He has to go there and he makes personal contact. He has to understand the culture. If he does not make regular visits, he will lose his business most likely. His livelihood depends on it. Is he going to be motivated? Yeah. If you want to put food on the table, you want to be doing that. And so they valued some things about relationship even with other countries that was fairly new. Now, really our Western tradition of education being about serving government or perpetuate the idea of government has its roots right here in Athens. So in Athens, when you were 7 years old, you went to school. Families that could afford a slave, it's called a pedagogue, would hire a slave for a very small fee, of course, and use them in the work of educating their children. They did this by having these pedagogues walk beside them in everything. That included correcting incorrect grammar. I'd like that job. Punishing misconduct. It wasn't the moms and dads. Tutoring. They even carried the books for them. Little 7, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old had a slave beside him. All, if you could afford it. If you couldn't, you sent them to the schools. And there were tuition-based private schools. And so they were not state-sponsored like Sparta, but they were tuition-based. And there the boys would go to three different elementary schools. The letter school, reading, writing, arithmetic. Music school, where they learned poetry and how to play the lyre. And thirdly, the gymnastics school, a glorified phys ed. Now, Plato makes it clear in his writing that the content was important, but it was also very important as to the kind of person it produced. We send our son to school, I quote, to see his manners even more than his reading and music. And so the aim of an Athenian education was to produce a young man who would be charming in person, graceful in his mannerisms, a beautiful soul and a beautiful body. If there was a difference because the body was so beautiful. You ever wonder why we have Olympics? There's an emphasis on the body. Okay. Athens. Athens did not have biblical standards, though, of personal morality, make no mistake. Secondary schools studied more technical things, including geometry, horsemanship, military tactics, rhetoric, mythology, composition. And then Plato and Aristotle founded higher education in Athens, and they formed this, what they call a circle of knowledge, or the liberal arts. And there they learned grammar, rhetoric, dialectic, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, music, and science. Does that look at all close to what we do today? Greek education was extremely powerful. It produced some rather historic figures, actually. Their education system worked. Pericles was an incredible orator and could convince you of anything just by his oratory skills. You have Socrates. The purpose of education was to think very rationally and question everything. And actually, you know, some of us employ his methods, by the way, in logic and thinking. The Socratic method of questioning. That's actually a good method. his approach maybe was, there was his worldview was obviously very suspicious. But he thought you should think about everything in life, not just the military or the state. Plato was a student of Socrates. And he saw the mind and the body not connected. Truth was all about the head. The physical had nothing to do with the intellect. It was about the mind. And truth searching centered on reason at the exclusion of revelation. Revelation impossible. You think. And then you have Aristotle. He was the tutor of Alexander the Great. Very effective, I might add. And he rejected, though, that knowledge is priority. And he said, oh no, what matters is the physical. This thing of ideas and truth and reason, skip it. It's all about the physical. Doing is as important as thinking about something. Now, all these men had a significant impact on education. By 86 BC, Sulla, a Roman general, took over the city of Athens. And Athens became a part of the Roman Empire. What's interesting here is that usually when a nation conquers another, the conquered nation is forced to assume other ideals and other culture, right? Not so in this case. Not so. Conquered Greece was able to impose its ideas, its languages, its institutions, the whole world. It's amazing. And so we come to Rome. Thomas Davidson says, and I quote, "Passing from Athens to Rome is as passing from poetry to prose, from an artist's picnic to a business house, from a people seeking to make the present beautiful and to enjoy it rationally and nobly, to a people that subordinates or puts away for now present enjoyment for future gain, from a people that lives by reason to a people that lives by authority." Rome didn't have the broad-based literacy. It did not have the oratory skills. They didn't have speaking skills of the Greeks. But they were incredible in their practice of law and in their gift of administration. They were born and bred administrators. So Greece impacted our world through language and literature, and Rome by its organizational skills and military might. Now, Roman education borrowed from both Sparta and Athens. What served as their foundation, though, was the law of the 12 tables. Law. In the same way we say the Bible is the base for what we do, Romans said, oh, the tables of the law are what we do. And it had to do with civil law. And here again, Romans were incredibly brutal with their children. Incredibly brutal. There's a reason the Apostle Paul told fathers, "Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." That was not out of a vacuum. That was not said just because it was a nice thing to say. It was because it was a real thing for children, whether it was at home with the father or at school with the teacher. By this time, Greek education was morally rotten and filthy. The Romans saw it. They tried to stem the tide of all this filth and the way things were starting to go in culture. And they stemmed the tide, tried to, by making laws. But there was too much filth in the education by now. It was too late. Their organizational skills did lead them to creating three different types of schools: elementary, secondary, and higher education. Now, Rome's foremost thinker was Quintilian. And he had really radical ideas for that time. And his ideas were later embraced in the Renaissance, which is a long, long time from now, okay, from where we're at here. He said you should reward for good and not just punishment for bad. One of the content subjects was discipline. The teacher carried a strap with him. Quintilian said, you shouldn't do that. Reward for good, and not just punishment for bad. He said that reading and writing skills taught to three-year-olds can be done if you use games and songs. And here you thought you had a brand new idea recently when you found a new game or a new song, right? Quintilian beat you to it. He thought you should use educational toys in the classroom. He said you should study and play with some balance. Not all study, not all play. And he said, furthermore, Romans, you don't need to start your schools at dawn. It's not necessary to have that many hours. Now, Quintilian was very, very, very effective in changing a lot of things. But the pendulum swung. And with time, Rome outlawed private schools, and the public system paid teachers. And as the government declined, public schools were taken with it. And used public loosely there. Well, now we have Jewish education from 75 BC to AD 70. The Jews did not accept Jesus as Messiah. However, in the stream of Hebrew education, which would be before the exile, to Jewish education, which is after the exile, is obvious that the Old Testament was extremely important to them and motivated them. Deuteronomy 6, we know this. Hear, O Israel, Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, with all thy soul, with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. And thou shalt teach them diligently. And you know the rest of it. Now, with the exception in Jewish history of Samuel's, or in the Old Testament, I should say, with the exception of Samuel's school of the prophets, the word school is not mentioned. But it goes without saying, basically, that the Jewish people were committed to training their children. The Hebrew language, E.B. and Arrow would note this, Hebrew language was rich in words that have to do with instruction. At least 34 root words imply the idea of teaching, and the words teach and teach were frequently used in common everyday language. They bled teaching. There's a little under 500 synagogues, and they worshipped on Saturday, of course, and the elementary school was held at the house of the book in the synagogue. They added a room onto it, usually, and the expectation was that every synagogue has to have a school in it, and the Old Testament was the textbook. And, of course, I noted before that the Jews were the first to establish a church-supported religious school system complete with compulsory attendance laws for citizens of all classes. It was no longer for the rich and for some. It was meant for all. What did the Jews believe? They believed in a God-centered education. The Torah was at the heart of what they did. Learning was an act of worship. Love God with your heart, soul, mind. Love Him with your mind. God-centered, coming under the Lord. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. It was God-centered. It was not about getting a job. It was about making them into good people. There were moral absolutes. Obedience to God and parents was non-negotiable. And I could read scriptures in 1 Samuel 15 and Deuteronomy 21, Proverbs 6. There were moral absolutes in the law and in the method. And they memorized. Oh, those children memorized. You think your students have trouble memorizing a few things? Bible memory, you know, wonder, what's happening to memorization? Well, in their oral tradition, they could memorize, folks. And they did, too. They memorized an incredible number of moral absolutes. They saw education as having to do with lifestyle models, a strong emphasis on the person. Parents were to model a disciplined life. Teachers were chosen from those who demonstrated a virtuous life. They said, and teachers in that day were the most respected members of the community. Respect your teacher as you would God. It's almost frightening. The teacher precedes the father, the wise man, the king. What does God do during the fourth quarter of the day? He sits and instructs the school children. The world exists only by the breath of school children. I believe every one of my resources quotes these kinds of sayings that demonstrate the importance that they placed on education. They use real life situations. They use history to teach practical everyday lessons. I wish I had time to read Psalm 78. But they taught practical daily lessons. The feasts were teachable moments. Memorials were set up to teach. And finally, who's aimed at training the whole person in living. The whole person in living. Rather than merely thinking. There was a movement away from those house schools and smaller schools at a certain point, and they saw that the fathers could hardly keep up with their work and teaching the children. And so the circle of parenthood got greater. And that's when the teacher became that important. Because the father said, I need help. I really do. The rabbis also saw the insufficiencies and made sure that the parents, the dads, knew they were not doing their job as well. School began about sunrise. How do you like that? With a session in the morning, another in the late afternoon, there was never any vacations as far as we know. There was a saying that you should never keep a child from going to school, even if they were building the temple. School was not suspended on the Sabbath. They had school the Sabbath in the afternoon. Now, they wouldn't study a new passage on Sabbath. That would be working too hard. But after church, then they would. There's a reason in 2 Timothy 3, it says, in that from childhood you have known the Holy Scriptures. Educating children was paramount to a Jew. The school, Lewis Sherrill again, the true protectors of the people were regarded as being not the political leaders, but those who instructed the youth. The school was held in highest regard as a symbol of all that education meant to the Jew. There were problems, of course, in Jerusalem. Priests didn't always care for the poor. They taxed their own people, controlled too much money. They were a mess. But Greek, Roman, and Jewish education laid the groundwork for education for two millennia. Before I can leave us today, I need to talk. Spend several moments looking at the smartest man that ever lived. The most amazing teacher that ever walked the face of the earth. The man who changed everything. Jesus, the master teacher. He fits in here too, you know. He wasn't just a teacher, though. He was a master teacher. But he was also the Son of God. He was master and Lord. Initially, the Jewish people, of course, found him to be quite scintillating. And it was fashionable, intellectually stimulating. People enjoyed hearing Jesus because he had this way with words, and he really did. The problem was he wouldn't cater to popular taste. And furthermore, he spoke authoritatively rather than simply swallowing everything that had been given in Greek and Roman education, as well as the problems in Jewish education. But much of Jesus' words in the New Testament are rooted in a teaching context. He truly taught out of who he was. He didn't set the ethic, he was the ethic. He taught profoundly by his life and example. He knew the power of modeling truth, and that inevitably his disciples would become like himself. Learning was the means of relating to Jesus. But the goal was much more than getting the facts down straight and taking all the right notes. Learning was living for the disciples, living with and like Jesus. Learning was becoming and being like Jesus. Education was not just mimicking the habits and the ways of Jesus, it was growing into being like him. The strategy was interesting. He taught masses of people. He taught the 70. He taught the 12. He taught Peter, James, and John. I love this quote from Ken Gangle, Warren Benson. When we read the Gospels, as if for the first time, we're struck with the freshness and creativity of Jesus' words. We do not find him drilling the disciples on his material. Although there are powerful lectures in the Gospels, the virility and spontaneity of his speech is amazing. Almost every page vibrates with vivid metaphors, similes, and hyperbole, or exaggeration. Along the road, in a home, with a little group in a boat, are the prosaic locations of his encounters with people having all kinds of needs and problems. Sometimes his teaching came in response to questions. Christ delighted in dialogue. For him, every event and conversation was an important learning situation. That creativity was something one could not teach by example alone. It was caught by the contagion of being his companion. The good news was to travel from person to person through enthusiastic live communication. Each person was important to Jesus. What they believed, they thought, who they thought he was, mattered. And you look back historically on Sparta and think 700 years of a Spartan education. The word means something. Spartan. It comes from Sparta, of course. You look at the losses there. You look at Greek education and you look at their ideals of the state and a republic and all these kinds of things, and you say, wow, they're pretty effective, and there was truth there. There was. But you look at the kind of person it created, and you say, oh. You see, the church, whenever it got serious, said, we're going to care about education. Who got the schools cranking? The church. Whenever the public system came to the forefront, government was in charge. Government was in charge. And the government shaped education. Sometimes it started really, really well in the ups and downs, the ebbs and flows of ancient history. But as the government, so the education, and so the people. The Church of Jesus Christ was always concerned about what are we doing with our children, our progeny? What are we going to do with them? Schooling was a part of it. It was more than that. It was an education. It was more than a simplistic, let's learn a few things here. It was about living life in a certain way. Spartans educated a certain way and indeed got a certain end result. Greeks in Athens did the exact same thing.
they got an end result that they were hoping for a while. Jews still having schools, still continuing their education. Christians, in a day and age of choice, can't make this all about ancient history, you know. There's a master teacher that says, come, follow me. I'll walk with you. I'll teach you who I am. The Christian church today has a tremendous opportunity to help in the forming and shaping of the church in 500 years from now. Today matters. Do you think as they educated in Sparta and Athens, they thought about 2,500 years from then? Do you really think Socrates felt like he was somehow changing the course of how people thought? I highly doubt it. In their more arrogant moments, maybe. You never know how you're shaped. You are a part of something going on. You realize? This week, we're looking at Christian school education. And I hope that as we do that, we keep in mind there was the greatest teacher that ever lived, Jesus. And he calls us to educate in certain ways.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.